Okay, and from Trump, we have to talk about Boris. Obviously, it's become a weekly Boris watch now. So I'm joined now by Andrew Gilligan, senior correspondent with the Sunday Times. And Andrew has covered Boris in his role as a journalist, obviously, but he's also worked with Boris on and off over the years. Andrew, good afternoon.
Afternoon, how are you?
Good. And do you think Boris is getting a bit of a hard time in terms of coverage, do you?
No, I'm not sure I'd say that. I don't think that some of the things that are said about him, that he is like the British Trump, that he's a racist, that he's a, you know, he's a kind of habitual liar. I don't think those are fair. I think the criticisms of him, I don't deny he deserves criticism in all sorts of ways, but the criticism of him is a bit subtler than that, I think. And I don't think those kind of almost cartoony criticisms land, because people see they're not really right, and I think there's a thing called Boris derangement syndrome. You had Trump derangement syndrome in the US. People hate him so much that they start going over the top. They start calling him a fascist, a Nazi, and things like that. You have a bit of that with Boris as well. People hate him so much that they lose sight. You know, they kind of lose proportion in the criticisms they make of him.
Andrew, to lay out your credentials here. How well do you know Boris, and tell us your various interactions with him down the years?
I mean, I know him a bit. I wouldn't describe myself as all that close to him. I've known him for about 20 years, first as a journalist. Obviously, he was a colleague of mine at the Telegraph when I worked there. And then I wrote for him at The Spectator for a bit, when he was editor of The Spectator magazine. And then for 3 years, 2013 to 2016, I worked for him at City Hall when he was Mayor of London, as his cycling commissioner. So, you know, we built some cycle lanes and things in London.
And did you build a shed as well, or demolish a shed with him?
That's right. I went in. This is about 10 years ago. I went into the to his office at City Hall just for a kind of routine journalistic interview, and he'd just been rung up by the Daily Mirror. He just moved into a new house in Islington, and hadn't got a study, because all the bedrooms have been converted to bathrooms. The previous owners were Americans, they were obsessed with hygiene, so they converted all the bedrooms to bathrooms. And he decided to build a shed for a study on a flat roof, a sort of first floor flat roof that he had. And unfortunately, he failed to get planning permission. Which
yeah,
was
he
a bit
built
of
a shed on a roof.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a problem, because he was in charge of the... He was in charge of the London planning system at the time. So anyway, the local council, which is Labour-controlled, grassed him to the Daily Mirror, which then just literally, as I walked through the door, more or less, at City Hall, just rung him up and said they were going to do a story about it the next day. So he was in a complete panic, and he just kind of seized on the first sort of remotely friendly face he knew, which turned out to be me, to try and enlisted me to try and help demolish this thing before the paper came out the next day, and before the kind of media circus ensued and anybody else was able to get pictures of the thing. So anyway, so we went back to his house, and we spent a couple of hours crawling around on the roof trying to demolish the shed before realizing we were both completely incompetent at any kind of practical task, and also in quite serious danger of falling to our death. So kind of not totally unlike British politics now, you might say, but yeah. he is, I mean, I think he did eventually get somebody in. He got like a professional workman in to do it, but we didn't have much success demolishing the shed, let me tell you.
So in general then, how would you describe Boris?
There's an old history book called 1066 and all that, which divided people into roundheads, who were right but revolting, and cavaliers, who were, you know, romantic but wrong. And Boris is definitely more of a cavalier than a roundhead. And he appeals to a lot of people all over the place, including in Ireland, actually. My family's Irish, I know lots of people in Ireland, I've got an Irish passport, as it happens. But he appears to lots of people in Ireland and in Britain who don't like the kind of sort of political correctness is a boring word, but it sort of sums up that kind of attitude that kind of priggishness. He appeals to a lot of people like that. Now, whether that qualifies him to be Prime Minister, that's much more debatable. But I do think that the politics, not just in Britain, but politics in lots of places, is broken politics as usual. And Boris is Boris would be a huge gamble. He would be. It could go spectacularly wrong, but it could also go very right. And the alternative, Jeremy Hunt, strikes me as just the kind of embodiment of politics as usual, which has failed pretty comprehensively.
So you would say
with nothing
left to lose, essentially, that people would take a chance on Boris because he seems to have a bit of energy about him and a bit of crack kind of thing?
There's plenty to lose, obviously, but I do think that in a funny way, Jeremy Hunt's almost as risky as Boris, because he's the risk that we carry on a bit like Theresa May did, sort of conventional politics and trying to do all the right things and actually not managing it. And there's a real impatience in Britain, a real impatience in lots of countries with that way of working. You know, the reason people voted to leave the EU was not really because of the EU. It's because they felt that conventional politics and economics was not working for them. And the referendum gave them a means to express that. They felt excluded from the conventional political system. They felt outside the conversation. They felt their views were not allowed to be heard. And they felt economically disadvantaged as well. And lots of, you know, the Brexit referendum was won by lots of people in small towns and places that, you know, the media never went
so
to.
So, Andrew, you could be describing... You
that,
could
that,
be describing
that
is, how the election of Donald Trump and the Trump base is described.
Yeah, but I indeed could, and I think the forces which have produced them are similar, but they are not similar characters. To give you, I mean, anyone who knows what Boris was like as Mayor of London would know that the parallels with Trump just don't work. Boris was basically a liberal centrist as Mayor of London, and you know the one time he's had real power. He did all sorts of things which were firmly in the centre. He raised the London living wage. He spent lots of money on public services. He funded medical help for refugees. He took out space. This is what I was involved with. He took out road space from cars for cyclists and buses. Something which absolutely infuriated his right wing base. And he was staunch about all that. So the idea that he's a Trump politically is wrong, but he does benefit from some of the same forces.
What were his weaknesses that you saw when you worked with him?
Well, one of the common weaknesses that people say about him is he doesn't do detail, and that's true. I mean, he's perfectly capable of doing detail. He could do it whenever he wanted and needed to. Like the one occasion he had to present something in detail himself to a big meeting that I couldn't do on the cycling side, he was brilliant at it. We gave him a 30-minute briefing the night before, and he was pitch perfect. But mostly he didn't want to do detail. And actually, I always thought that was a strength, not a weakness, because I think a leader's role is not to get themselves immersed in the detail. The leader's role is to set out the general direction and tone, to choose the right people, and then to inspire them to implement it. And Boris is really good at that. And you know, we've had a couple of prime ministers, two out of our last three prime ministers really now, Gordon Brown and Theresa May, have been ferocious detail people and deeply, deeply unsuccessful prime ministers, probably the second and third and their first and second most unsuccessful prime ministers we've ever had. So detail alone doesn't get you there. So I don't think the criticism that he lacks interest in detail is a valid one.
You were at the hustings yesterday, Andrew, were you? Just one second, Nora.
Yes, I was, yeah. I was at Carlisle in Manchester.
Yeah, and you were talking to Boris yesterday.
He came over. I was writing my piece afterwards, it was a Carlisle racecourse, and the press bit was in one of the boxes in the stands, and then there were like private rooms for the candidates a little bit further down. And I was sitting outside on the balcony, and he saw me writing on the balcony and came over and kind of looked over my shoulder, tried to rewrite the intro, actually. He was on reasonably good form in Carlisle. He was, you know, kind of full of gags. I mean, I did come across several people who said that they like him as a person, but they didn't see him as a prime minister. And Jeremy Hunt was just more prime ministerial.
Is he having a problem as well in trying to present himself as a serious person? He sometimes looks... I was looking at him this morning on Sky News. When he's trying to do the serious stuff, he looks as if the air has been sucked out of him, and he's not the kind of Boris that people, to use the term, know and love. Is there an element of that?
I think that's right. I think that's a very accurate thing to say. I think the he can do Sirius. One of the most interesting things about his mayoralty of London, again, you heard the same people saying the same things before he became mayor, that it was going to be a disaster, he couldn't handle anything serious, London would fall apart. It didn't happen. One of the most interesting things about his mayoralty was this kind of boring competence at its central tasks. All sorts of things which are going up now, like council tax and crime and air pollution and traffic congestion, they went down under Boris. And all sorts of things which are going down now, like you know, bus usage, capital investment, number of houses being built, they went up under Boris. He was actually extremely competent at the central task. He was good.
It was hard about getting the
right team around him, but it wasn't just the team. It was the it was the way he managed to set the direction and inspire them.
Andrew, do you think he should have answered questions about his private life in the last week?
I do, actually, and I think he hates talking about it, and he I still don't quite know the whole story. I think it would have been a lot simpler if maybe he or Carrie had just made a brief statement. Didn't have to be a kind of great TV interview or anything like that. Just a brief on the record statement saying this was a marital or a lover's argument of the kind that happens in lots of partnerships, and we were grasped on by these politically motivated neighbours, and that's the end of it. And
I think same politically motivated neighbours who made him take down that shed on his roof.
That was a different lot of neighbours.
It's the same kind of thing, isn't it, Andrew? Those Guardian reading neighbours, we all have them.
Well, you know, he and Carrie's, their flat's in Camberwell, which is a kind of quite middle-class part of London now. It used to be quite rough. It's been really gentrified now, and it's full of the kind of people who really hate his guts. two of them called the police, which I think is fair enough, if they were worried about somebody's safety. The police then came and told them, these neighbours, that there was nothing to worry about. They then tipped off the Guardian, which I think is a slightly dodgy bit. And I think so Boris is within his rights to be cross with them, as I think he was. But I think he could have shut the whole thing down a bit quicker and made it just a bit simpler. If you know, he or Carrie, preferably both of them, just issued a statement saying, look, this is what happened. It's been blown out of proportion. Can you respect our privacy? They didn't do that. And as a result, the story rumbled on longer than it should have done. Maybe that's because, I don't know this, this is pure speculation on my part, maybe that's because she didn't want to. I don't know.
Okay, Andrew, I want to bring in Nora Owen, who's a former Minister for Justice.
Good afternoon, Andrew. Andrew, listening to what you're saying about Boris and the kind of things that people seem to like about him, I have to say, he's not running for a place on Big Brother or Love Island or anything. He's running to be the Prime Minister of a country that is in really dire difficulties. And I just wonder what you would say to people who say, look, one day he says one thing, the next another. I mean, the airport issue, his stance on Turkey joining the EU and then withdrawing it. Everything he says, he can quite glibly just discard. And so essentially what you're getting is a blank sheet. And maybe is what he's aiming for, so that people can't say you can't do a deal with Brexit because you've already said this or that or the other. I mean, are these not issues that the Conservative members who are voting are concerned about?
Andrew?
Well, bluntly, I think that's part of his attraction. You're right. I mean, one of the fascinating things about him is that who knows what he truly believes. I do think, as I said in the piece I wrote for the paper a couple of weeks ago, that his kind of factory setting is one nation Toryism, and he was a notably centrist and liberal mayor of London, but at the same time he said some things which are against that clearly, but interestingly that is perhaps part of his appeal, because he is a slightly blank space politically, but in policy terms that people can project on him what they want. What they want for themselves. So that is why he is able to have the support of both Marc Francois, who's the ultimate hard Brexiteer, the ultimate crash out without a deal Brexiteer, and Damian Green and Damian.
But Andrew, he's got to be lying to somebody, isn't he?
Well, interestingly, look. firstly, in terms of saying different things at different times, they all do that. Obviously, Jeremy Hunt was a Remainer, and he's now firmly committed to a hard Brexit if necessary. I mean, that's not much more credible than Johnson's position, to be honest. They're all the same on that. The appeal of Johnson is he is such a kind of two-faced opportunist, if you like, that he might find, that this is what a lot of the Remainers who are backing him think, he's such a two-faced opportunist that he might find some way to sort of weasel us through this terrible mess that we're in. He might find some way to sell what is basically a version of Theresa May's deal with knobs on. He might find some way to sell that to the hard Brexiteers.
Okay, Andrew, I want to bring in Ian Guider.
Yeah, Andrew, I was listening to Boris give the interview with Talk Radio where he said he would leave on October 31st, come what may, do or die. Given that he is the personality that flip-flops and has no fixed position, why are the real Eurosceptics you mentioned Marc Francois and Jacob Rees-Mogg, why do they trust him to actually leave on October the 31st?
Well, you'd have to ask them.
But you see, that's the question. Do the ERG actually trust Boris anymore? No, I get an inkling they don't, do they?
I think they probably trust him more than the alternative. They probably trust him more than they trust Jeremy Hunt. And that's what we're down to. We're down to choices between alternatives. I think some of them would have preferred Dominic Raab, who's the ultimate hard Brexiteer, as their Prime Minister, but he crashed out pretty early in the voting. It's absolutely clear that Boris is going to end up disappointing some of his supporters. There's no way he can keep that kind of broad coalition happy. But the hope of people, I mean, lots and lots of Remainers support Boris. George Osborne, Damian Green, Damian Collins, lots and lots of people who voted Remain. And their hope is that he can somehow he can somehow wangle it so that he'll come back with something which he can sell to the hard Brexiteers. And I think that is a possible outcome. I don't actually think the EU wants a no-deal Brexit. They blinked in April. They blinked in March. I think it would be very damaging to them. It would be hugely damaging to Ireland, of course, which is an EU member. And you know, they care about Ireland much more than they care about us, I'm sure. They don't want a no-deal Brexit for those reasons. And they also don't particularly want, I don't imagine, a kind of permanently alienated large country off their northwestern coast.
So this is fundamentally what's going on here. The gamble is that you think that if Boris brazens this out, that Europe will blink, that Ireland will not get the support, and that Boris will win in the end.
I think one of the main reasons Europe will blink is they don't want Ireland to suffer the fate of a no deal. Because I think
I know it's going to be very damaging to Ireland, Andrew, but are ye deluded over there about what a no deal Brexit is going to do to the UK?
Oh, no, I'm not. Obviously, it'll be hugely damaging to us, but I think it might be just as damaging to Ireland, maybe even more damaging.
Colin, as an economist?
Andrew, at the very beginning of your remarks, you made the point quite reasonably that Johnson has been unfairly painted as a fascist and all this kind of stuff. But the rest of your remarks really amounted to saying he's not a fascist, but he's a chancellor, and that this is a qualification to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And that's kind of sad. And it's sad in particular when on all the credible analyses that have been done, the no-deal crash-out that Boris is happy to court will do enormous damage to the United Kingdom. One of the reasons why people in Ireland are bothered about a no-deal crash-out is precisely because it will do a lot of damage to the United Kingdom. Nobody here wants to see the UK economy weakened. Why on earth would we? You've made a case for Boris Johnson. Perhaps you didn't mean to make a case for him, that amounts to saying, trust this guy because he's a chancellor.
I don't think it's quite what I was saying. But you are clearly saying,
trust this guy because we don't know what we're going to get. Trust Boris because he might not be the Boris we think he is.
I'm not saying trust him because he's a chancellor, but you are saying,
aren't you, let's try Boris because we're not sure what we'll get and we might not get what we expect from Boris. Is that roughly the line of thinking?
What I'm saying here is that part of Boris's appeal to the wide spectrum of opinion is that his kind of...
He's an empty vessel.
empty vesselness in policy
okay.
that makes,
yeah.
Allows people to project onto him, allows people of widely varying views to project onto him what they want to see. And I think it is possible, and as I say, I've always thought, I don't believe that we will end up with a no deal. I don't believe that actually he or Hunt or anyone else wants a no deal. I don't believe the EU wants a no deal. I think they probably will come back with some kind of superficial twiddle to Theresa May's deal. This is my central case, that they'll come back with some kind of superficial twiddle.
Despite
to,
the fact that
Theresa
they have
May's
made it
deal.
Clear all the time, Andrew, are you hearing this, that they continue to make it clear that that is not going to happen?
I think that... I don't actually. I think you've heard different signals. Actually, I think you've heard
okay.
different signals from the likes of Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, who is the new leader of the CDU. You've seen different signals from other places in Brussels. The signals have not been consistent.
Okay, I
that.
Suppose it depends
but
on what you're choosing
think, look,
to hear.
I don't think they will change the deal dramatically. I think they will change the deal just enough to enable Johnson to sell it as some great triumph and. And, you know, we'll see whether the Eurosceptics will go for that.
God, I hope you're not relying on a lot of what-ifs there, Andrew. Grainne Healy wants to come in.
Yeah, I think Andrew's own story about the story of the shed on the roof, I mean, I'm horrified that this guy who may be the Prime Minister, you know, was building a shed illegally. It's unsafe. And he was only taking it down in case the media got hold of the story. So in Andrew's own words, you know, this guy is a huge gamble. But this is not just about... you know, somebody who's going to run the local shop, this will be the guy who will be leading, Britain and in a scary way. But I think one of the key worries I have is it's not so much that he flip-flops on things, it's that he's actually quite a fantasist. And in this way, while I know you were trying to make a big difference between himself and Trump, there is an element of the fantasist Boris that is quite scary. So, for example, in terms of what he has promised to do around the Irish border, in his view, there'll be a technological approach that will mean customs and regulations will take place automatically. Everybody who is anyone on this is saying that technology is
okay.
years away from...
I want to let Andrew answer that. Andrew, is that a bit unfair to suggest that he's a fantasist?
I don't think it's completely fair. I think that I don't underestimate the difficulties that the UK finds itself in and the difficulties that Ireland finds itself in through no fault of its own as a result of the UK's decisions. But I don't believe that the gap between what was proposed and between Theresa May's deal and what could be accepted by the UK Parliament is all that small. Even Theresa May's deal came quite close at one point to being accepted by the Eurosceptics. Back in March, there was a moment where if Geoffrey Cox, the British Attorney General's advice, had gone the other way, she would have got her deal through. I think.
Would she, Andrew? Is the backstop not only the beginning of the problems with that deal? That once, if the backstop was fixed, there would still be huge problems with the deal for
a lot
of Tories, wouldn't there?
The deal is only a withdrawal agreement. The future relationship still has to be negotiated. But all I'm saying is that it is not. We were not all that far away from getting Theresa May's deal passed. Already, even with Theresa May, the worst saleswoman in British prime ministerial history, in charge of selling it, with a better salesperson and some tweaks, I think it could go through. And I think Boris Johnson is potentially that salesperson. And I don't think I'm not saying that, you know, the choices are ideal. I'm not saying that the country's not in a terrible mess. And I said right at the beginning, it's a huge gamble. It could go very, very badly wrong. And I hope everyone heard that.
Yeah, but sure.
I do think that that we need something more than politics as usual to make this work. And clearly, a lot of other a lot of other Remainer-type people also agree with me. They are backing Boris Johnson.
Okay, Andrew Gilligan, thank you very much. And we'll take a break.